Welcome to PodX Med, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. Mark, welcome to the podcast. Where are you coming from today?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm coming from Cape York. I'm at my house up in Bleeper at the moment today, which is lovely. I spent a lot of time traveling around, but at home joining you guys today, which is great.
So for our overseas listeners, you cannot drive or take a car up to Weeper in one day. Sometimes people come to Australia and go, oh, I'll just drive to Perth. It's just down the road, right?
Well, I thought you were going to say you can't take a car up to Weeper in one piece.
Well, I don't think the roads are very good, are they?
How far are you, Woody, from a major metropolitan hub?
So Cairns would be our closest metropolitan hub, and if I was in a hurry and didn't stop for regular intervals, it'd take me 10 hours to get to Cairns. 800 kilometres, roughly half of that being dirt road.
And that's also, I guess, the closest major hospital?
It is the closest major hospital, yes.
So we're talking 10 hours prolonged field care. We're talking long distances.
We are. We've got four stations up on Cape York, and it's a bit smaller than Victoria. So you're looking at a bit over 500 k's between ambulance stations.
And when we're talking about things like Victoria too, I mean, I guess we can align that to, we're talking about areas and distances almost the size of England up there. So we're talking about a vast area that you guys are operating in. You've got four stations. So are there paramedics at each one of those stations? Are there doctors in each one of these areas?
Yes. One of the stations does not have a hospital or a doctor. They have fly-in clinics. The other three stations have hospitals and doctors, yes. So, yeah, I don't consider it remote. I consider it isolated because when it rains, which it rains for about months of the year, we are completely isolated. We're blocked off. You can't drive in or out. And even if you wanted to get to Cairns in a hurry, you wouldn't be there until midnight if you left now. So it's pretty isolated.
So if everything works well, 10 hours. If everything's not working well, days.
Yes. If you take the front end out of your Land Cruiser, which I've done in the past for hitting a washout, it does take a few days to get to use.
Now, really quickly, I mean, when we talk about things like expedition medicine, wilderness medicine, extreme environment medicine, quite often people will actually align this to mountainous areas, cold areas, polar regions, things like that. Can you just give us a quick rundown of the basic geography up there or the geographical challenges that you actually work in?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very different. We do have a very low mountain range. The Great Dividing Range does cut all the way up through to Cape York, but highest elevation would only be a few hundred metres. This is very flat. It's vast. A lot of mining goes on in this area, a lot of bauxite deposits and stuff like that. And it is very flat. It goes from mud to dust. So it rains for about 4 or 5 months and everything is just slosh mud, and then it dries out and everything is just dust. And it's quite extreme. But the marine environment, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, is off the charts as well. So it's quite an interesting place to work.
And this is, I guess, this is one of the reasons why we wanted to get you on the show, because, you know, you're working from all things, you know, lush rainforest through to sparse bushland into, like you said, sandy areas, and then even marine and coastal. You've got a lot of coastline up there.
Oh, yeah. And the coastline is, I've done it before. I've put my own boat in around this area where I live and taken it all the way up to Torres Straits. That's a full day of boating, and you will not see another person or another boat being tied through.
Wow.
So don't fall out, I guess. Now,
many people get in trouble up there out boating, and how do you respond to those incidences?
Well, actually, I'm actually a commercial skipper as one of my qualifications. So I volunteer. We have a VMR, a volunteer marine rescue up here, and we actually went out and rescued a guy on Saturday. So it doesn't happen all that often, but when a boat breaks down, the only option is the water police, which we have in the Weeper, or VMR. So we do pick up maybe half a dozen a year, and some of it is just running out of fuel, which is madness, but the rest of it's just breaking down. Yeah, just engine stopping and that's it.
It's always interesting too when we're talking about geographical challenges. And I mean, one of those too, you're talking about the rain periods. You guys suffer a lot of heat up there. What up 40, mid 40s Celsius. What's also the population? Whoa, how many people are up there?
Well, we're in the most populated hub here in Weipa, which has got 3,000 people. But there's only about another 5,000 people spread throughout the whole Cape, with almost 1,000 people on Thursday Island as well. There's not a massive population and they're so spread out. You know, there's cattle stations, you know, roughly the size of, you know, small cities up here. So, and once again, very remote and very isolated. So there's no phone reception. It's all satellite stuff. And it produces a lot of really interesting challenges. And I really enjoy working up here because of that.
It's interesting. 5,000 people, Nick, in the area of a country like England.
That's crazy.
And you've only got several responders working in that area who then link into things like VMR and, you know, skippering vessels and... I think they've got to be reasonably self-sufficient. Did you know, Nick, that up there, this is the only place in the world that we still have two living dinosaurs?
Really?
I believe so. Mark, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Am I one of them?
Look, you've been out there a long time. So we've got the estuarine crocodile, which has been around since the dinosaur periods, and we've also got the cassowary.
The cassowary.
The cassowary.
They're quite aggressive, those things.
They can be. They've got a massive horn on their head. They've got a massive hook on their foot, and they stand about, well, halfway up a grown adult man, Mark.
Oh, they'd be taller than a grown adult. Right. Absolutely.
It's like a really angry emu.
With colour.
With colour. A colourful, angry emu. Speaking of crocodiles, have you had any incidences or been to any incidences involving crocodiles? And how do you approach them? You're out in the water a fair bit, so you've probably come across a few. What's your interactions with the crocodiles out there?
I actually went to a crocodile attack in town, which is quite rare. You know, most of them are quite remote. But this was back in 2010, where there was a guy who was fishing in one of the local creeks that was situated right next to the local pub, and the croc came out and grabbed him, dragged him into the water. All the blokes from the pub heard him screaming, so they all raced out and managed to pull him out of the water, but his legs were shredded because the crocodile does what they call the death roll. It grabs hold and then starts spinning. And he was holding on to some mangrove roots while the crocodile was doing the death roll on his legs. So a horrendous crocodile attack. There was another one which I didn't attend that just bit a bloke in the chest, gave him a pneumothorax and a few other bits and pieces going on there. But so look, you know, they do happen from time to time. Most people don't live to tell the story. And, you know, with me, it's impossible not to encounter them. I tell everyone, if you want to find out if there's a crocodile in a piece of waterway here on Cape York, if you put your hand in the water and it comes back wet, there's a fair chance there's a crocodile in there. So they're just absolutely everywhere. So you do bump into them all the time. And, you know what, it becomes a part of your life. So I wouldn't say I'd be complacent, but I get very comfortable, fishing beside a crocodile that's not too far away.
It's not complacency, but it does also boggle my mind because on one hand you're like, yeah, this guy literally got grabbed by a croc and so his mates ran out of the pub and basically wrestled him out of the croc's mouth and, well, they probably went back to the pub after that. But then, you know, you're also talking about this other one that bit the guy on the chest and, you know, he just had a sneaky pneumothorax 800 kilometres from any kind of help in 10 hours. And, you know, the challenges that you face up there are... They're mind-blowing for some people who have not ventured out of the metropolitan hubs. And this is also why the Academy has been developed and grown, is literally to, I guess, put spotlights on these kinds of stories, bring these kinds of people together. But, hey, one of the things that I really wanted to pick your brain about today, Mark, was actually marine envenomation or marine stings, because this is something that I guess is controversially discussed in different circles. And there certainly seems to be some discrepancies in the information that we're fed. There's certainly, different tribes essentially who are advocating for different managements of these things. But Really quickly, I mean, up north, the northern ends of Australia, they're renowned for some of the most lethal creatures in the world, not just crocodiles, but also jellyfish. What kind of jellyfish do you have up there?
Well, the main one we have here is the boss jellyfish. There's a few, the Coronex fleckeri, the scientific name for our box jellyfish.
Whoa. Let's just run with box jelly.
Only because a lot of jellyfish get called box jellyfish.
Right.
But the Coronex fleckeri is our, and which is a 3 meter long jellyfish with a bell about the size of a grown man's head. So they're a big jellyfish, and they're the most venomous creature in the world. So they're incredibly lethal. We did have a death up here in May of 2022, unfortunately, up at Bamiga, just at the very tip of Cape York. Not many people swim in the waters around here, but, you know, when you do, you take your life in your own hands, unfortunately, because they're very hard to see because they're clear and they're incredibly lethal. They're just nasty.
Three meters. I mean, you wouldn't even see the bell once those tentacles are touching you.
No, 100%. They're as long as, almost as long as my boat. So when I do see them in the water, the bell couldn't be at the bow of the boat and the tentacles are still down towards the transom. So they're a big jellyfish.
What, there's a couple up there though. What else have you got?
Well, we do have the Irukandji, but the Irukandji is more of a deep water jellyfish. And like I've said to, you know, some of the doctors and stuff that talk about Irukandji things up here, if you can survive getting through the crocodiles in the shallow water, then the box jellyfish after the crocs, then all the bull sharks after that, get stung by an Irukandji and make it all the way back to shore again, you've had a pretty good day, you know, let's face it. So
you deserve to live.
We don't have a big issue with Irukandji, but they certainly do when they go scuba diving around Cairns and on that eastern side of Cape York. So
does that help with your decision-making around, like if you're going to someone who's been stung by a jellyfish, does where they've been stung make a big difference to what you're suspicious of? Like if they're swimming off a beach versus if they're gone on a snorkeling tour off the Great Barrier Reef?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And the symptoms are so different as well. So, if you can survive 4 or 5 minutes after being stung by a box jellyfish, you're probably going to be all right. But it takes about 20, 25 minutes to even get a symptom from an Irukandji sting. So they're two completely different stings, completely different symptoms. So they're pretty easy to pick apart.
Now, with the box jellyfish, there's a few treatments that have been proposed, from first aid treatments like vinegar all the way through to antivenom and magnesium. What's your perspective on how we go about treating them? What is effective? What's contentious? What works?
Well, I've conducted my own field study on this, which was unintentional.
Sample size of one.
Sample size of one. So not a huge award, I'll give you that. However, look, this was in 2009, and I was up a river called the Pine River, which is probably an hour, 45 minutes to an hour from Weipa. And I did get when your fishing lure comes back, it sometimes has box jellyfish tentacles hanging off it. Because you can't touch them, I've got a technique where I just do a big loop and slap the lure on the surface of the water while it's hanging off the end of my fishing rod to break all the tentacles away from the lure.
Sounds safe.
Yeah, what could go wrong? Seriously. So one particular day, a clump of tentacles did come flying off the lure, landed on my forearm, which I'm looking at the scars still as we talk right now, and I just had this incredible, intense, burning, slicing through flesh kind of pain, like it was horrible. And I carried vinegar on the boat because it was going to happen sooner or later. So,
now can you just talk to us quickly about vinegar? Because as you know, I mean, all through my childhood growing up in North Queensland, there was vinegar stationed all down the beaches. Every child at school was taught that if you're stung by a jellyfish, vinegar, 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 and seek medical help. So vinegar has been the standard treatment, so it's no surprise that you've got some in your boat being up there.
no surprise at all, because what the idea behind NVIDIA is there's on the tentacles of the jellyfish, there's what they call pneumatocysts that are like barbs that fire into your skin and like little harpoons, and they release the venom. They got a little venom sac in them, and they're obviously just tiny little barbs. And the vinegar is supposed to neutralize those pneumatocysts from firing any more venom after they've been activated.
And that, however, that can also make it safer then to remove tentacles, correct?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Sorry, back to your case study of sample size of one.
It wasn't my finding anyway, which was interesting because I poured the vinegar over my arm and the vinegar was sitting under a hatch in my boat and in a bucket with some other stuff. So I grabbed the bucket and put the bucket between my legs. And as I poured a 1 liter bottle of vinegar over my arm, I caught all the vinegar in the bucket so I could refill and just keep pouring vinegar on my arm. But by the time I poured that 1 liter of vinegar all over my arm, I was laying on the floor of my boat. I was so nauseated. I thought I was going to vomit. I was sweating. I had that impending doom. I'm going to die here on the floor of this boat with this little the tiniest little box jellyfish thing. It's almost embarrassing to talk about. It's so small. But that's how I felt. And then after about 10 minutes, I started to come good again. I mean, the pain was still excruciating, but I wasn't, on the floor of the boat, feeling like I was going to die. So I poured the vinegar back into the bottle, poured it over my arm. This time I was vomiting, projectile vomiting, back to feeling like I was going to die. And I thought I just need to put more vinegar on it. I just need to keep putting vinegar on it because that's what we're always told. Then I've always been very interested in especially marine medicine, but, extreme medicine in all aspects. I read a study done by James Cook University in Cairns, headed by Jamie Seymour, who's as mad as they come, but a bit of a guru when it comes to all this sort of stuff. And he found that the vinegar does not stop the pneumatocysts from firing once they're activated. The original study was done on tentacles that weren't activated. So when a tentacle gets comes in contact with flesh, it fires and becomes activated. So if you dip the tentacle in vinegar, then put it on someone's skin, it doesn't fire. So we thought, well, all you got to do is pour vinegar over, box jellyfish tentacles. But when they are activated, you pour vinegar on, they fire up to 60% more venom than what they did the first time.
Good.
So what you're telling us is on your journey back in, every time you poured the vinegar on your arm, you felt worse because you were basically envenomating yourself that little bit more.
Well, I only did it twice.
Right.
which was probably wise because I was able to start the engine and start driving towards Weipa. I went forward for a little bit of help as well, which was lovely. But it still didn't click that I wasn't doing the right thing. I still thought I was doing the right thing. It was just unlucky that, this envenomation was coincided with me pouring vinegar on these. And I was thinking to myself, imagine if I didn't have vinegar, imagine how sick I would have been. But then I read the study, 3 or 4 years later, and I'm thinking, son of a bitch. Yep. That stuff makes sense now.
It's an interesting study though, Nick, because you said it's 2009, Mark. I mean, this is, 15 years old now, and we see the Australian Resuscitation Council that actually puts out a lot of the guidelines. They have not changed their practice. They're still recommending vinegar. Why?
Well, it was only one study, and that's the challenge sometimes with...
Well, it was one study in a lab as well.
Well, that's true. And if you really want to change practice, you need to have replicated findings. So if, say, another...
We've got two studies. We've got a sample size of one from Weipa.
Well, so what Mark needs to do is publish his sample size of one study, and that's our second study, and now we can change the ARC guidelines. So I think it's one study, and until someone else replicates it, there isn't that onus to change it. And the vinegar still does stop new nematocytes from discharging. And it's very difficult to know what the ratio is between undischarged and discharged nematocytes. So it's not that like slam dunk per se study that's going to change practice altogether. And, you know, like it's like adrenaline and cardiac arrest, right? We know it doesn't work, but we're still going to do it.
It might work.
It might work.
Right.
So we'll just keep doing it anyway.
This is medicine at its finest, yeah. Mark.
It's a science and an art form.
The challenge, sorry.
They say it takes one study to introduce the treatment, but it takes 100 studies to get rid of it. That's what we're faced with
at
the moment.
Mark, what would be your recommendation? So if you're teaching a first aid or teaching a clinicians about how to manage an envenomation from a box jellyfish, and they're like, should I use vinegar? I don't know. I'm confused now after your experience. What advice would you give?
Well, see, that's just it, Nick. I'm in the same boat. We do need more studies to confirm what I believe to be true. And I do believe that vinegar doesn't work. Jamie Seymour and his crew at James Cook University, they're in the same boat. And I've discussed this with Jamie. Jamie and I have met quite a few times. But, mate, 100%, you know, you need to be so sure that it doesn't work before you start telling people, geez, don't pour vinegar on it, whatever you do. However, when I do have conversations with other paramedics or doctors and nurses about this, I do share my findings with them and say, look, there's a lot of research to say it doesn't work, and here's my own personal experience. And then you have to run with, you know, whatever you feel's right. I don't carry vinegar in my boat anymore. And
unless, you know, it's a barbecue. Hey, The Simpsons has a lot to answer for, though, Mark. I think a lot of my American colleagues sometimes bring up the same thing over and over and over whenever they're coming up to work in these, you know, North Queensland marine environments, even Northern West Australia. It's the same discussion. Hey, man, can I pee on it?
Yeah, well, that's another one, isn't it? Urine has been tested and studies have been done on the effects of urine on jellyfish stings. And we can categorically say that, yeah, it does not work. but, you know, old wives' tales, yeah, can you convince, you know, certain people that, you know, if you're stung by a jellyfish, urinating on it isn't effective? It's the same thing with vinegar, isn't it? You know, a lot of people are going to keep using vinegar no matter what.
Well, Homer Simpson said it works, so people are still thinking about it. But, I mean, the last person I spoke to that had this happen to them said it was the worst day of my life. Not only I was stung by one of the most venomous creatures in the world, I also had my friends piss on me. So let's put it out there right now. Let's say it doesn't work. Let's say...
You've heard it here first, guys.
We're not advocating for that. Don't take medical advice from the Simpsons.
My concern would be I've been out fishing in 35-degree, 40-degree heat for 6 or 7 hours. And if you're in the boat we've been stung and you've got a bad jellyfish sting screaming at me to urinate on it, not only would I probably go sage, I'd get a bit of sage fright. I'd be dry as a chip. I'd be like, well, how about I get you a bit of vinegar? How about you get that crack?
what about hot water? Does that do anything?
Yeah, hot water does, actually.
Or seawater.
They found
a bit more jellyfish.
No, they actually did studies on hot water, but they did find cold ice packs and hot water both to be as effective as each other, which unfortunately the box jellyfish is cardiotoxic as well as dermonecrotic as well, but it's the cardiotoxic portion of the box jellyfish sting is not affected by heat. It's just the pain. But they did find that, you know, half the patients got relief from hot packs, other half of the patients got relief from ice packs. Ice packs are a lot easier to apply than hot packs, so they are suggesting that on small stings, you just put ice pack on it.
And you're literally talking about those little ice packs that you can just break. You pop the bag inside the bag and they become cold. Is that the other ones you're talking about?
That's it. Yeah. Effective for the pain, but it's really important that everyone knows that the cardiotoxin in a box jellyfish sting in the contraction cycle of the heart contracting. Sorry, I didn't say that too well, but when the heart contracts, the cardiotoxin freezes the heart in that contracted state, and that you go into cardiac arrest like that. You're not talking VT or VF. You're talking, straight asystole, basically.
Sounds pleasant.
Yeah, it's a nasty little bit of gear.
Well, there's talk of, like, especially up north, they do carry anti-venom. And there is some evidence around the use of anti-venom that it may reduce the incidences of the patient going into cardiac arrest. But when you really look at the data of, 90% of people who are envenomated survive, and of that 10% who have a cardiac arrest, they generally stay in cardiac arrest. And the administration of anti-venom, once they're...
You're talking about box jelly. And,
correct.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah. Once they're in cardiac arrest, it doesn't change their outcome. There's no evidence to suggest it does anything once they've arrested.
The challenge of the anti-venoms too is, where can you store it, and how long does it last?
It's got to be refrigerated. It's not kept on the ambulances, from my memory. Back then, it wasn't kept on the ambulances. It would have to go to a station, pick it up, take it out. And by the time you got to the patient, you're 20, 30, 40 minutes into an arrest, it's not going to change their outcome.
We're in the same boat here. We carry anti-venom, but we carry it at the station now. We had fridges in the vehicles, but because the ambient temperature in the vehicle gets so hot, parked out in the sun, that the fridges were just failing and the anti-venom was getting lost. So, but the other thing you've got to think about too is, like I said at the start, if you jump into the water and get hit by a box jellyfish, if you make it out of the water and you're not in cardiac arrest, then you're probably going to survive. You're only talking 2 to 4 minutes of, if you survive 5 minutes, then you're probably going to survive. And we're not going to get any benign into you in 4 or 5 minutes. We're not going to be on this fork. So its effectiveness has been proven, so we do use it. But, we're using it on patients that are going to survive anyway.
You can see why it's such a confusing topic for people operating in these environments, because are we using vinegar? Are we not? Are we using seawater? Are we using hot water? Box jelly, anti-venin, is it available? If it is it working? Has it been refrigerated? Is it still active? Magnesium, does magnesium have a role in box jelly stings?
Yeah, it seems to improve the pain levels and the stuff like that. But once again, you're talking about patients that have survived.
And again, I mean, access to magnesium, morphine, fentanyl, sometimes in the areas you just don't have it.
Mm.
The best you might have is paracetamol for a couple of hours. So there's also been a lot of talk about about stinger season. We talk about stinger season a lot, Nick.
Mm. It's a big topic in Australia about, there's these defined periods of the year where stingers are more active.
Well, when is that?
Well, they talk about the summer season.
Yeah, it's the hottest period when we all want to jump in the water.
100%. So anywhere, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, anywhere from about September through to April. Is that about right?
Yeah, we find box jellyfish. I think that's the case with Eritangi.
Mm.
Box jellyfish do, I'll say breed or spawn, even though they've got a really interesting lifestyle. Life cycle, but we find from about December through to as late as May, probably you'll still see a few box jellyfish, and the start of our wet season is when they all come out of the rivers. The now mature box jellyfish come out into the waterways and stuff, and they can be in big swarms, and it can be quite frightening actually to see such a large amount of them coming out of the rivers. They actually start their life as a polyp stage, and then they have to attach. So they're basically just a little floating embryo, and they attach to something solid, like a tree root or something like that, and they turn into this little marine growth type thing, which is really fascinating. That eventually branches out, and little baby jellyfish comes off, like breaks away like leaves off this little growth, and then only then do they start to form their bell and their tentacles and stuff like that. And this can take months for it all to occur. And only those now maturing box jellyfish come out of the creeks and rivers here in Weipa in massive swarms around about that December, January time.
Yeah, right.
How do turtles eat these things?
I was just about to ask, are box jellyfish, are they dangerous towards other marine animals or they're just like killing humans?
You know, the few times I've caught a fish and the fish has been unlucky enough to come back to my boat and go through some box jellyfish tentacles, it's dead by the time it hits the boat.
Can you still eat it?
No, I don't eat it because it frightens me.
These are little bastards of the sea, that's for sure.
Add vinegar. And some chips. That's a bit of salt. Yeah. It's a good meal.
It's just, I mean, we can't touch these things. Fish can't touch these things. The turtle can literally eat it. And that's why, I mean, that's why it's so important too that we protect our beaches and waterways from plastic and things like that, because the turtles can fuse those. And
there's something new we can tell all the overseas tourists. Come to Australia. We've got all the snakes that will kill you. And just for something different, box jellyfish swarm. Now, on the topic of Irukandji jellyfish, I think you mentioned before.
Sorry, Nick, to be a pain, but can I just add some research that Sydney University has done? They found that that cholesterol is a required component of the sting of a box jellyfish being cardiotoxic and being as painful as it is. So they're currently looking at a lotion to block cholesterol from being able to activate the box jellyfish sting. And there's been some really positive outcomes with it. So I'll just throw that out there just before we move into Irukandji. There's not much else to say about it at this stage.
Yeah, right.
But the research does look promising. So.
Almost like a sunscreen, like you put it on as a preventative thing?
So, yeah, from what I read, it's...
Would you like to volunteer to be a
sample size of one?
Sample size of one.
No, been there, done that, and I'm not going back again. I've got to tell you, it's
yeah, wow. Now you mentioned before about Irukandji jellyfish and its association or stronger association with this idea of stinger seasons in Australia. Now I did some reading about this idea of stinger seasons, and there was some thought that's being put around now that stinger seasons seem to correlate in the north with the trade winds and particularly the absence of a southeasterly breeze that when it's not there increases the amount of Irukandji stings. Have you heard of this association between Irukandji and the wind?
I have. Yes, and I'm a Gold Coast boy and I know Sunny is as well. Grew up on the Gold Coast, and it's exactly the same with the blue bottle. As soon as the southeaster softs and that northerly pushes in, the blue bottles are up on the beach and Irukandji are the same. And the thing about a box jellyfish actually has eyes. We're unsure how well they see, but they can swim and maneuver around, and that's why you don't see box jellyfish washed up on the beach. But Irukandji, not having this that level of control like the blue bottle down south, when those winds change, the current starts to push them up onto the beach, and then all of a sudden they're where people are swimming instead of, you know, being a deep water jellyfish.
And I think this is why, like, traditionally those winter months are the non-stinger months, because you do get these quite consistent southeasterly winds throughout those that part of the year. And traditionally, you'll see them abate during the summer months, hence why you have a stinger season in those summer months. But I know the CSIRO are looking at using these wind forecasts to do stinger warnings. So when they see that there's going to be a lull in the wind, about 48 hours to 72 hours after that, that's when they put out warnings to beaches and tour groups in the region that there's more likely to be an envenomation.
I hope they call it a swarm warning. Not a storm warning, a swarm warning.
Possibly.
You're exactly right. And guys that do spend a fair bit of time, you know, in the water for work purposes or whatever, they'll tell you, you know, it's for me, I found as soon as that northerly wind kicks in for a little while, they all start getting washed up on the beach. But you're exactly right, Nick. If it's been blowing, you know, 15 to 20 knots southeastern for a few days, and as soon as that wind drops out, that current changes and we start seeing jellyfish get washed up on the beach.
Now, Sonny, you've done a little bit of work as a medic in some areas with stinger swarms. How do you change your approach to keeping your team safe when you're operating in these kinds of environments full of jellyfish and crocodiles?
Well, look, moving forwards, Nick, I'm actually going to get a cholesterol gel and smear them with it and think it's fine, because then we're going to get a much bigger sample size. Probably won't get ethical approval. No, look, really simply, anywhere we work, it doesn't matter if you're in the mountains, if you're in a polar region, or if you're, you know, in the warm oceans, jungles, there's always going to be elements of risk. As soon as you take people from, you know, defined structures such as roads, houses, hospitals, electricity, and take them out into areas such as Mark's working in Weipa, the risk of things increase. I mean, I don't think there's many people in a pub in a city have had to leave their beer on the table and run and wrestle their friends out of a crocodile mouth and then go back to the beer. You know, so risk always increases in these things, and you'll find a lot of the research teams are not forced to work in these kinds of environments, but certainly that's where they collect the most data. A lot of the documentary teams that are filming things that people watch on TV are also moving into these areas. And there's, like Mark said, there's also a lot of exploration mining as well. So there's a lot of groups of people that require care when they move into these areas. And a lot of that will come down to the medics involved. And a lot of the work, I guess, and Mark, you can certainly speak to this too, it doesn't just revolve around the clinical aspects of response, like so many of us are used to. It actually revolves around prevention. How do we stop it happening in the first place is often the best medicine. And so when I have been responsible for these teams, it's very simple strategies. One is using local knowledge. How bad are they? When are they worse? When's it safer, et cetera? What do you guys use? What can we do? And so we know that these nematocysts on the stinger tentacles are chemically triggered by skin or the pH. And so literally wearing a stinger suit. I mean, back when I was a kid, we used to wear mum's stockings into the water, because that can literally prevent the stingers coming in contact with your skin. So making sure we are covering people from head to toe. It's not comfortable, but it is safe. When we get them back on the vessel, making sure we do a thorough inspection of them, flushing them down. And I mean, the irony is, because of the work we do, we actually suffer what we call secondary stings too. When people were checking dive equipment or, you know, research equipment or even camera equipment coming back on the boat, like Mark said, sometimes you do to get tentacles on those. And so making sure, you know, people are wearing gloves who are doing the inspections, making sure when we're flushing people with the buckets of water, we're not splashing unnecessary areas of the boat and actually trying to wash it away. But then also building the medical kits so that we can respond adequately. And this is why these conversations are so important, because the ARC is what governs a lot of our practice, and they still advocate for vinegar. So we would actually be, it would be a big please explain if we were operating these areas without vinegar. But also understanding, you know, the research that came out of JCU, you know, people like Mark's experiences too, taking that on board just to, I guess, put a lot more consideration into how we are managing these things. You know, there's a lot of people advocating for just flushing jellyfish stings with seawater at the moment. Now, that does create a risk of flushing with seawater and more tentacles if we're just getting buckets out of the water. So you do need to be cautious. We do need to be careful. It's very difficult to improvise and adapt an approach to this if we don't have vinegar, if we don't have antivenine, if we don't have pain relief. I believe, Mark, you once coined it as diesel treatment.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of treating with diesel.
Can you explain that to the listeners?
It's a fast trip to the hospital.
It is using whatever vehicle you have and a fast trip to whatever hospital you have. So it is not. It's not using diesel on the sting. It's using diesel to transport people to these areas. So it's one of those things too, Nick. It every single time I've come out operating in these environments, there's always lessons learned and things that I will do differently. As I'm sure Mark literally changes and adapts what he does up in the far reaches of far north Queensland. Mark, I find it interesting. When I grew up, winter for us in North Queensland was relatively safe to swim as long as there weren't any crocs or lost jellyfish or cassowaries on the beach. And now we're finding that maybe it's something, you know, a contributing factor such as the wind. And, you know, back when we were a kid, it was vinegar, 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 vinegar. And now we find out that we might have actually been hurting people. So, I mean, it's important to, I guess, note that medicine is constantly in flux. Research is always changing the space in which we operate, but all we can do is, I guess, respond how any reasonable person would be expected to respond in that situation. But it, it's challenging, hey, up there where you have very limited support, you do need to think quickly on your feet sometimes.
Oh, look, 100%. There's, and talking about just minimizing the risk, that's basically all you can really do. There's, unfortunately, you know, just to get my boat on the boat trail, I've got to walk into the water. And there's no way around that, but, you know, minimizing it and just being wise and a bit smarter, very important. And, you know, just good sound practice, you know, like if vinegar is still going to be the first line treatment for, you know, doctors, nurses, paramedics, first aiders and stuff like that, then so be it. But we should really be supporting a lot more research into this and, you know, looking at, you know, is it really causing any harm? Because I personally believe it is. And I think you guys have come around over the years after listening to my story a few times now.
Yeah, and Mark has supported more research. I do appreciate his approach to this. I've never actually seen him on a boat in a short sleeve shirt, so this must have been the only day that he had a short sleeve shirt on to whack his own arm.
The first and last time. It'll never happen again.
Short sleeve shirts, but I used to roll them up all the time.
Yeah, it's hot. It's hot.
Hey, this one, now I never, ever roll my sleeves up. So, it's the little things, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, Mark, listen, thanks so much for your time. Now, you do have a YouTube channel where you post a lot of your wild and wonderful Far North Queensland adventures. What is it, if anyone is interested?
I'm like, that's fantastic. It's so Wardy is Wardy's Fishing. So any all things on fishing Cape York, you can find on Wardy's Fishing.
Yeah, so if they just went to YouTube, typed in Wardy's Fishing, that's, what is that, W-A-R-D-S Fishing, Wardy's Fishing, they'll be able to see what you are up to and they'll be able to contact you through there as well. Nick, I think it's been fun.
It's been great. Thanks for coming on the show, Mark. It's always a pleasure, mate.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to see you guys too.
Maybe we need to go up and go for a little fishing adventure.
He's offered. He has offered.
What are we doing here?
Yes. Winter is apparently safer. Not for crocs or jellyfish.
There's no crocs in winter. Safest houses up here in winter.
No cassowaries. No swarms of box jellyfish. Let's do it.
I think we need to.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the first episode of the, or not the, PodX Medicine Podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the Academy, you can find our website. Just pop over to Google and type in the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. If you'd like to apply to be a fellow or find out more about the fellowship process, you can send us a message or an email through that website and we'd love to speak to you. We've got some awesome things coming up on the podcast over the next few months. So watch this space. If you've got any ideas, topics, things you'd like us to cover, or interesting experiences that you like to share, please reach out to us and we'd love to get in touch. Sonny, it's great to have you on board today.
Thanks for having me, Nick. It was wonderful. We'll get Wardy on again in future because he's got some other wonderful wild adventures too with other crocodile attacks and remote vehicular responses. So it's been fun. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. See you next time.